to imagine all life as you know it stopping instantaneously and every molecule in your body exploding at the speed of light.
Total photonic reversal.
Photonic reversal.
Photonic reversal with your host, Conan Neutron. Broadcasting from a secret underground lair in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
A gigantic middle finger to everything that is rock about music, rock and roll, and corporate power.
The thing is, though, if you don't laugh, you're going to go on a killing spree with sharp and nails.
Confidence of a hero or a fool, I wasn't exactly certain which.
Could not be more professional.
It means something.
And they got away.
You know, that's my take on it. Like, what's yours?
Protonic reversal!
That's like a science thing, right?
Indeed, indeed, indeed it is. It's a science thing. It's a science place. It's a scientific fact that we're all up in your face. It is time, once again, for the one, the only protonic reversal. First protonic reversal of the summer. First protonic reversal of the summer. Boy, am I feeling it out there. Also, first one since coming back from U.S. tour. So we got a bunch of episodes coming up back on a regular schedule. Very excited to be kicking it off in mere minutes with incredible David J. Very excited to talk to that guy. But before we do any of that, welcome to Conan Neutron's Protonic Reversal. I'm your host, Conan Neutron. I'm a rock and roll lifer that's been touring and recording for 25 years, most known for the band Conan Neutron, The Secret Friends. Music is a huge part of my life, and I use the format of this very long-running podcast to talk about music with musicians whose work I enjoy and respect, but who may or may not be household names. This is episode 426. Now, if this is your first time listening to the show, archives of it are available for free. No ads, no sponsors, no kidding at protonicreversal.com. However, if you want to support the show and get episodes sooner, $1 a month at patreon.com/protonicreversal will achieve that goal. If you like the show or even just a single episode, please feel free to like, subscribe on your platform of choice, share it around on the internet, even leave a review. All that helps people discover the show. It beats back the almighty algorithmic overlords. It's just a darn nice thing to do. So here we go. David J., remarkable individual. Just being in Bauhaus or Love and Rockets alone would be enough distinguishment to sit on his laurels. This is not a guy that sits on his laurels at all. And very excited to talk to him about the most recent release, two releases, really. The Mother Tree, which is the record. There's accompanied, paired with a book of poetry called Rhapsody, Threnody, and Prayer. And, you know, a little bit of everything else. This is a guy who's done a lot. And I'm very excited to have him on and talk about basically all of it. David J., welcome to the show, man. Appreciate it.
Hello, Conan.
And you are going by Haskins now, right?
Well, I'm going by Haskins for this particular record. And
okay.
Really, just as it's a doff of the cap to my family, to my mum and dad. Both of whom are not here anymore, but I know that they would appreciate that, and especially as the book is the main piece in the book, and the main piece certainly on the record, The Mother Tree, is about my mother and it's a tribute to her.
Did you, because historically you have not done that, was that just a nod towards distinguishing yourself from your brother and kind of having your own identity, or what was there a rationale behind that really?
When we started Bauhaus, I don't know, I had this idea that I could keep a part of myself private, and that's David Haskins.
Right.
You know, that's David Haskins goes to the corner shop, the local library, and sure. Isn't bothered. And somehow there's that a power in retaining my own name for that. Outside of that, showbiz, I wanted the name, so I just used my middle initial, J for John, and they extended it initially, J-A-Y, I spelled it out. And then I later on abridged that to J.
Well, and it's, you know, it's got that, oh yeah, it's David J. Yeah, you know, of course. Yes, you know, that's impressive sounding. It's got a mystery about it, right? And that's lovely.
It's got more of a ring to it than Haskins as well.
certainly. Well, let's start off with the most recent. Now, I think this is interesting because the record you referenced and the one that I mentioned in the intro, The Mother Tree, it's a tandem release. There's a book of poetry and a record. And there's songs, like there's music set to the words. And I think this is interesting because my understanding for this is that you went to see your friend Nora play. Right. Mm. And you with the intention of you know, who a lot of us do, which is like, I'm just going to see the set. I'm going to take off. And that's going to be the end of that. But that's not what happened. Correct.
That's right. Yeah. Because she was on in the middle of three acts and I was about to leave. And then this group was setting up. I still have a little bit of my drink left, my Scotch. So I thought I'll just savor that and I'll just check this lot out, see what they like. Maybe stay for the first number, you know. And as soon as they started playing, I was riveted. And they were excellent. And it was all instrumental music. And they were obviously semi-improvising, I could tell that, really well. And they were listening to each other and responding. And at the time, I had in the back of my head the idea of doing a spoken word record with music. And I wasn't sure if I was going to do all the music or I was going to bring it in other players. But as soon as I heard this group play called Rakia. The three-piece, violin, guitar, and keyboards. I was just struck by the notion that they could be a perfect backing band accompanist for what I wanted to do. And beyond the spoken word, maybe some songs as well. And what I had in mind in the moment was this could be a bit like One Can Only Aspire, but Astral Weeks.
Oh, yeah, by Van Morrison. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And that was semi-improvised, and it's sort of some of it's spoken word. And it has this sort of free-flowing, poetic kind of feel and atmosphere. And I thought, yeah, they've got something of that quality, which can really work with what I want to do.
Yeah, because there's something very atmospheric about the tracks, because you get your violin, guitar, piano, right? Like, and it gets kind of dreamy in sections. And it's the kind of thing that it's lush and dramatic enough that it kind of can add a different dimension to the words, right? Rather than just like reading
the
page.
And subtle when it needs to be, right. Which is a lot. There's a lot of subtlety in it, but they were just such sensitive listeners. And I approached them there and then at that gig and said what I had in mind. And then we were in the studio within days recording the first piece. And I sent them the piece and I said, I'm leaving it to you to come up with the music. And I don't even want to hear it until we're actually about to record. And just play me a little snatch of it and I'll give you direction if necessary. I think I just told them to slow it down a little bit. Yes, that's all. But I only heard like 20 seconds of it and I knew it was right. And then we went straight in and recorded it. Everybody playing live and me doing the vocal live, and it was one take.
That's great. And that shows a lot of trust in the creative process that, you know.
Yeah.
When it's folks you don't know, it could be dealer's choice in a number of ways, right?
Yeah.
No, and it's an interesting release because of that. And I do not have the book. So I've heard the record. I've not read the book. But it does occur to me, too, that there have been studies that have shown that the brain interacts with art in a different way musically versus a spoken word, right? Like that there's certain crossovers, certain neurons fire for a language versus music as art. And it's interesting to have the melding of the two. And I keep thinking of, some of the beats and things along those lines that like you almost can't divorce the music from the words sometimes because they're so intrinsically tied, and it just engages the art appreciator in a different way.
Yeah.
Did you have any other than Astral Weeks, which I absolutely heard? Did you have any other things you were thinking of as like a touchstone, or like, oh yeah, maybe a bit like this or something along those lines? Or was it just kind of let's just see how this works?
Yeah, no, I didn't really have any other touchstones. No. It's an original piece of work.
Have you always written poetry? Because I know you write lyrics, because...
Yeah.
But poetry and lyrics are very different things.
Yeah, I have. Very sporadically. I mean, I'm more apt to write a lyric. But occasionally a poem comes along. And they're two very different things. Poetry is more... It's not bound by structure in the way that a lyric needs to be. Right. The lyric, it has to have a structure, and that structure suggests heavily the musical form, you know. But with poetry, it's just free form poetry, and it can just go out there, and it's more expansive, you know, in that way.
Do you find creatively that it tends to flow out mostly all at once, or just come in pieces and you have to put them together like a jigsaw puzzle, or how does it normally work for you?
All at once. And that's true for lyrics and poems for me. But sometimes I'll come out with the main piece and then I'll hone it. Mm-hmm. But the initial spurt is just a rush of, you know, verbiage.
There's, I mean, famously for Bela Lugosi's Dead, you wrote the lyrics to that. And my understanding, and it may be apocryphal, is that one came out fairly early on and kind of, you know, almost fully formed together all at once. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, at that time, it was really right at the start of Bauhaus, of course, 78. And I had a job in a warehouse just packing up boxes and shipping them out. So I would always have these colored labels in my back pocket. And I had those with me when I was bicycling home after doing this job, really boring job. Uh-huh. And then the night before, Daniel and I, we'd been watching this season of horror films. And the latest one was Bela Lugosi, Vampire. So we'd had a conversation because we were trying to arrange when to have a rehearsal. And it just came up in the conversation about, oh, did you see that vampire flick? Yeah, yeah. No. So we had a chat about that. Then that led into talking about all the different vampires, all the actors and the vampires, Christopher Lee, and going right back to Max Schreck. And
Nosferatu, yeah.
Yes. So that was a conversation. It was just in my consciousness. And it just sort of bubbled up on this bicycle ride home. And I just started thinking of those lines. And then every now and again, I'd stop, get out some labels and write down the lines, you know, white on white, translucent. Okay. Ah, black capes back on the rack, you know.
Yeah.
Bela Lugosi's dead. Bela Lugosi. And by the time I got home, I had the whole thing written out on these labels.
On the labels that you had with...
Yeah, which I don't have. I mean, I transcribed it to a bit of paper and just threw those away, not thinking...
Oh, that should be like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or something, right? I mean, or at least sell them. Yeah. Private collection.
Anyway, so I think it was the next night we were in rehearsal and I just handed this sheet of paper to Peter.
Yeah.
And then as we were doing those days, we just start playing, jamming. Just all start playing, not with any. There's no direction. We're just playing, and something out of that mist, arises, and you, without talking about it, you all sort of leap on that and focus on it, and that becomes the direction of this music. So with that, it was Daniel playing, like heavy echo guitar,
very dubby. Yeah,
yeah, that was right. The idea. He had a thing called a WEM copycat at that time.
Nice.
Which is an analog tape echo. And he was just mucking around with that. And then Kevin started playing, of all things, a bossa nova beat. Right. Because he'd been taking drum lessons from a jazz guy.
Right.
And then that was one of the two rhythms that he knew. So he just started playing that. And then Pete was like mucking around. We had like a space echo, and he was putting echoes on that on the drums. That sounded great.
Yeah.
I just came up with that bass line, the descending bass line. So this is like the music is happening. And then Peter, he's walking up and down with this lyric, brooding. And then he just comes out with it, like, as you, pretty much as you hear on the record.
Crazy. And then, you know, next thing you know, history is being made. But it's interesting to me because for a couple of things. First of all, Bela Lugosi, great onomatopoeia. Right, just the sound of his name is just, it's got such a musicality to it. Bela Lugosi, you know, it's such a nice thing. And then I like the idea of, you know, I'm just trying a different kind of drum beat because it was one of the first songs I heard where it's like, oh, wow, what's this all about? Like, this is a little different, isn't it? And, you know, in an appealing way. And it really was ground zero for a lot of things. And this is very early on with the band.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this is like the rare case where somebody makes their one of their most iconic songs is like one of the first ones out of the gate.
Yes. Yeah. We'd only been together less than 6 months.
And do you just know you're on to something special immediately? Or is it just like.
Totally. Oh. No, there was magic. It was.
Yeah.
We all got chills playing that.
Well, because I'm thinking forward towards, because I do a movie show. I'm a panelist on a movie show, and we did a month of vampire movies, like going through all of the different movies over the years. You know, starting with Nosferatu, you know, Dracula, Christopher Lee, so on and so on. But The Hunger, like arguably, that's not the same movie without you guys in it, and it's certainly not the same movie without Bela Lugosi's dead in it. And it's perfect. Like the club scene is just like, oh, this is perfectly setting up what these types of vampires are.
Yes.
And it just wouldn't work without it. Was that a good experience doing that movie?
Oh yeah, it was great. It was wonderful day. Yeah. Especially, you know, being on the set with Bowie.
Freaking David Bowie, yeah.
And Catherine Deneuve as well. Oh, who I was a big fan of, you know.
Yes. Yeah, oh, yes.
And we knew that club, Heaven in London. Mm-hmm. It was a gay club, but sometimes they would have like underground music events, really like cool bills. We played there. We played there with Clock Bay once.
Nice.
Anyway, it was a good atmosphere in that place.
Although Peter Murphy's the only one that really ended up on screen. In the movie,
I know it's really funny because we were having a joke. We were like, amongst ourselves, we were joking because we each got moments where they were filming us individually, for quite some time, you know, right. And reshooting. And then Kevin, myself, and Daniel were saying, "Yeah, there's no film in the camera. They're just doing that to appease us, and it's going to be all him."
The cutting room floor, right?
It's gonna be all him. In the cage. And then sure enough, we didn't go to the premiere, we just went to just a regular cinema in London, three of us, to go and see it, sat in the back row. And sure enough, the women section don't get a look in.
Right.
It was great. We loved it. I mean, we loved the way it was edited. We loved the first 20 minutes of that film.
Oh yeah, it's a really interesting movie, and it's funny that it's Tony Scott, because he's so much more well known for things like Top Gun, and you know these really like over the top action, and to have this movie that vibe wise certainly set a tone for vampire movies in the 80s, and on, and you know it's a formative piece, and there is a great soundtrack to it. You're amongst like great company with that one. And
Bowie was very involved in that soundtrack,
and which absolutely makes sense. Did you get to spend any time with him on there?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes, he was lovely. He was really nice, and he was sort of relating to us as and himself as like the boys in the band, like musicians outside of the acting scene, you know.
Right, because he's coming from the world of music too, even though he's
I had a very wonderful interaction with him personally, one-on-one.
Oh yeah.
When they were taking a break, they were setting up the next scene, so it was a bit of a break, and the band's like holding area, if you will, was next to Bowie's dressing room, which was immediately opposite Catherine Deneuve's. And in this area, they had an old jukebox, mm-hmm. like an old 50s Wurlitzer jukebox, and it was stacked with great records from the 50s. Fantastic. 60s and 70s singles, you know, 45s. And it was operational, so you could play it when they weren't filming, you could play it. So I was just there deciding what to play, and I became aware of a presence behind me. It's very strong, looming. And then I hear this voice, very familiar voice, pipe up. Do you mind if I pick one? You know, it's Bowie. And so, no. Of course I don't. So I decided, please, be my guest.
Yeah, all right.
So then he's sort of looking, and I was really intrigued to see what I was going to play.
Sure, yeah.
And he plays this track, Grooving with Mr. Blow, by Mr. Blow. Do you know that? From 1970. It's an instrumental.
I don't think I do. No, it sounds familiar.
Yeah, he's got a real, he's got a really good beat to it.
Okay,
it's an up tempo thing, and then he just starts dancing full on in front of me. So it was just me and him there. It was like a very surreal moment.
Sure, of course. He was
leaning it against the jukebox, trying to look cool.
You know, an ageless vampire in the rock and roll world. You know,
what's that?
He's a bit of an ageless vampire in the rock and roll world, right? I mean, he survives so much and continue to make fantastic music. It's like a larger than life figure. So just see him just, you know, getting down to was it Mr. Blow? Is that what you said? Yeah,
Grooving with Mr. Blow.
Grooving with Mr. Blow,
and he danced for the duration of the record.
Fantastic.
It was full on, like arms in the air, like
yeah,
you know, doing the Bowie moves. And smiling at me, and I'm like smiling back. He's like looking at me like all the time.
Right.
And so then I got cheeky.
Uh-huh.
My nervous hubris kicked in. And I said to him, this reminds me of something. Now, when I first heard Low, the track A New Career in the New Town, I was struck by the fact that I know that I'm pretty certain, well, it was confirmed later, that he cribbed the harmonica part from Grooving with Mr. Blow. It's like, it's almost exactly the same. So I said, it reminds me of something. He goes, oh yeah, what's that then? I said, oh, that's one of yours. He goes, what? Which one? I said, it's Off Low. He goes, come on. Which one? He's still dancing all the time, doing this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A New Career and A New Town. And he goes, winks, and puts his finger to his lips, and then carries on dancing.
Fantastic.
That was amazing. So that was affirmation.
What a guy. That's awesome.
And then the song finished, and he just walks by me and taps me on the shoulder and goes in the dressing room.
And he's just on to the next thing. Was Bauhaus already covering Ziggy Stardust at the time?
Not at that point, no. We weren't entertaining it. No, that came a bit later.
Well, and that's... that's one of the rare Bowie songs I think works, and one of the reasons why is because it's not an impression. Meaning one of the rare Bowie covers, I should say, that where it's someone's not doing a David Bowie impression, they put their own spin on it, right? It's uniquely Bauhaus. It sounds like you guys.
Yeah.
And I'm always kind of surprised when bands don't do that more, like when they have like it be a little bit too faithful, where it's like, well, why don't I just listen to the original one then? I can listen to that anytime I want.
Right. Yeah. It was a bit cheeky us doing that because we would get a lot of comparisons to Bowie.
Sure.
So it was partly done as a bit of a wind up, you know, to wind people up because it's like audacious.
Right. Sure. Yeah. I mean, like, it just wasn't done, I would imagine. I mean, like, I can't think of anyone at the time.
Right? No.
Well, and it's always interesting to, you know, come from that glam world because I always felt that one of the differences. Well, there are many differences between Love and Rockets and Bauhaus, but just the... Isn't it like Peter Murphy was that into psych, right? Like psychedelic music? It didn't seem like that was his...
No, Daniel and I were big time. Yeah.
And I think that showed through a lot more with the Love and Rockets material. Like,
I mean, it was suppressed because it wasn't a shared love.
Right.
But when we did Love and Rockets, and especially it really... worked in that time, you know, there was the whole Paisley Underground thing happening.
Right, yeah.
San Francisco, there was a revival of psychedelic music. And it was just a very natural thing for us to fall into. It just felt right, like the right music at that time.
Well, and there was, and granted, it isn't always the case. There's definitely pathos and emotionality and poignancy to Love and Rockets as well, but it almost is more of a fun band, if lack of a better term, right? I mean, I don't know if that's...
Yes, I mean, it still had its darkness, but there was an element of fun, certainly.
Yeah, and you know, that's something where it's rare for members that are so distinguished with one thing to try something different and have it really work like that. And the closest comparison, and I hate to say it, would be like Joy Division, New Order, right? Where it's like, no, this is the same guys, more or less, but it's completely different band.
Yeah.
A completely different feel.
Yeah. And as good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, depending on your mood, might even be better, right? I mean, and that's, and the same thing with Love and Rockets. Like, I remember, and again, in the days before the internet age where all information was available to you immediately, like, just the idea was like, oh, yeah, it's the guys from Bauhaus. I'm like, what? Really? This band? Are you sure? Like, this, it just didn't make sense at the time. And then I was like, oh, wait, actually, you know, if you stop and think about what they're doing, it actually does make sense. What was that initial step towards doing the Love and Rockets stuff? Like, how did Love and Rockets even come about?
Well, when Bauhaus split up that first time, Daniel and Kevin formed Tones on Tail with a guy called Glenn Campling.
Right, right. So they, the great.
And I went off. I had already started a solo album when Bauhaus was still going, called Etiquette of Violence. So it was just natural for me to just carry on and finish that.
Right.
And then that kind of just led into a bit of a solo run. Then I did another one, Crocodile Tears and the Velvet Kosh. And I was on this really great label, Glass Records.
Right, sure. Yeah, yeah.
Great guy there, Dave Barker, who's got really good ears, you know, very respected A&R man, discovered a lot of things. Spaceman 3 being one of them.
Of course, yeah.
And the Jacobites, you know, he's got really good taste, and he liked what I was doing, so I went with him. Then I joined the Jazz Butcher Group, who was also on that label.
Oh, sure, yeah, Jazz Butcher.
And I produced them. I went in on board as a producer, but then I ended up playing bass and being in the band for a bit. And then Daniel had a bit of a falling out with Glenn Campbell, so he and Kevin were wondering about asking me to come and join them in a new band. And I was totally up for that. We had enough break, you know, for that to be refreshing again.
There's a little distance from it. Everybody kind of got to do some different stuff for a while, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Absence makes the heart grow fonder, right? Is that the saying?
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Well, and that's... when you started in with that, did you have it like immediately? Because again, it seems like you were you coming at it more from perspective of grinding out in the room, or was it more of a, hey, I'm gonna, you know, bring this idea forward, this is the direction I'm looking for, so on and so on? Like, did that process change for you as you, because if you're making your own records, obviously you're the head honcho when it comes time to like what that's going to sound like. So I'm interested how the songwriting process developed.
We never had a plan, never talked about it. We just went in and did it with the belief that the identity will arise naturally, organically. It'll just come out, you know.
Like the music will tell you what it is.
Yeah. And the first thing we tried, because we didn't have any original material, was a cover. Let's do a cover. Right. And to get things going, you know. And Kevin came up with the idea of Border Confusion. As soon as he said that, we all thought, yeah, that could really work.
Yeah.
To do like a really radical kind of deconstruction almost of it. And then even change the lyrics to make it relevant to the time.
Right, exactly.
And we just worked exclusively on that track for 2 weeks in a barn in the middle of the countryside. We just worked and honed it and stripped it down until we were ready to, like, at the end of that time, go in and record it.
And how great to attack something that's, you know, not attack, but like it's a temptation. This is you know, Motown, Berry Gordy, and like you guys are coming at this totally different, you know.
Yeah, but we all loved Motown.
Sure.
You know, that was a very early influence. I mean, I'm a big fan of James Jameson's bass line and all his playing.
So good. Yeah.
I play like him in the way I play with one finger, you know.
I could totally see that. Absolutely.
Never use a pick.
Yeah.
Not that I was copying him, that's just naturally how I play. I didn't even know that he played like that until later on I saw films of him. But yeah, so we just did a number on that song, and we were fortunate in that we had a very simpatico engineer, co-producer in John Rivers, who had a studio in Leamington Spa.
Yeah.
And we really liked what he'd done on the Specials' Ghost Town. They recorded that with John, and John was very involved in that with Jerry Damas. And he really got where we were going with this. And he was like a fourth member of the band.
Right. And well, you need someone like that. That's going to, yes. You know, it's not going to work otherwise.
Yeah. And he had the right, and also an important thing for a producer, he was a co-producer, is to have the right attitude and to bring the right kind of sensibility, whether that is playfully goading, as he would do sometimes, or being sympathetic, and you know, just like keeps your spirits up and keeps the inspiration going. John's really good luck with that. So that works out great, and we ended up recording the two albums with him.
Right, because that's right, because he ended up doing Express as well, and that's got. Kundalini Express. I love that song. I think that's a great kind of underrated song within the Love and Rockets pantheon. That's a really interesting one, I think.
That was originally going to be titled Dr. Hoffman after the discoverer of LSD.
Fantastic.
And it mutated into Kundalini Express.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Basically,
awesome.
It's about the same thing.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
It's very psychedelic. The whole album is.
It very much is, yeah, and that's again where I was saying, you know, when it was brought up to me that it was the same people, it was like, oh yeah, well, that's not really Peter Murphy's vibe at all. Like this is entirely different. And that's I mean, God, wasn't that in like an episode of Miami Vice or something, if I remember right? Like it's in a couple of things.
Yeah, it's been placed a lot, and it still gets placed to this day.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's got kind of out of time sort of aspect to it. So that's the kind of, and Psych goes in and out of favor in the whatever's left of the monoculture, but I feel like whenever it comes back, you get people that have a deep listening experience and they really connect with it.
Yeah. They wanted to feature that tracks from that album, including Kundalini Express, in the film Dumber and Dumber.
Oh, Dumb and Dumber, sure. Yeah.
And at that time, now this, it seems crazy now, thinking back to this, we were offered a lot of things, and yeah. We were so purists. We would, before we committed, said yay or nay, we would demand to see the script, and then rushes, and to approve, you know, to give our final approval, because it had to be like the good quality stuff, you know, because we're associated with this, you know. And we saw some rushes from that film, and we just thought it was stupid.
Which, to be fair, it absolutely
stupid.
Is.
I mean, it intends to be stupid. I mean, we saw it out of context, really. You should have seen the whole thing. But we turned all that down. We turned down hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Because you just feel like it didn't fit.
It wasn't
up to standards. Yeah.
Yeah. But the soundtrack's really great, you know?
Right, yeah. Well,
in retrospect, you know, that probably wasn't a good idea.
Well, you never know. You never know until you know, right?
I know, but I mean, now, you know, please give us a placement. It's one of the few ways you can actually make some decent money. And also, it's super good promotion.
It really is. There's a number of directors that do listen to this show regularly. So, just saying.
Okay, we get a lot of placements these days. And it's interesting because a lot of the directors and the producers are early 50s now. They're our original fan base.
Right.
Yeah. And they got into us when they were teenagers. So they have that undying love, you know. So, and yeah, so we're called on quite a bit, which is great.
But do you find, like, when you've done these Love and Rockets reunion shows and whatnot, like Cruel World, and I mean, I feel like there's like younger audiences that are showing up that just weren't even around the first time, right?
Definitely.
I mean,
yeah. We meet them as well. Yes, they're like late teens, early 20s.
Yeah, and they're engaging with it as if it was like real time. Yeah.
And they've discovered the music, whether via their parents or just online. But they're really into it, and that's really inspiring for us.
Yeah, and that's certainly validating, I'm sure, you know. Yeah, the stuff, because some stuff will be big for its time, and then just is gone. It's like redacted from history. And then some stuff has, you know, it ends up saying it. I mean, I feel like Earth, Sun, and Moon, right? No New Tale to Tale. That is a timeless vampire of a song. Like, it's always going to be around. It's always going to be around, played at a party, and be like, oh, yeah, what's this? You know, I heard it in a bowling alley that we played at. And I was like, wow, this strangely works.
Yeah.
In a bowling alley yet. Can you tell me about the gestation of that song? Like, how did that one come to pass?
That was done, well, while we're in this studio, we're in a lovely residential studio, Rockfield, in Monmouth, sunny, surrounded by bucolic countryside, trees and fields. And at the weekend, I would drop acid, basically. Mm-hmm. And I got all that from an acid trip.
Like, really? Okay.
His revelation of what I'm saying in that song. You cannot go against nature, because when you do go against nature, it's part of nature too. I mean,
wow. And it's far out. Know, those are words very far out. I mean, it's words that have echoed across generations, right? I mean, not bad. And I think you've done that, you know, you've played that song on your solo sets. You've played that song plenty. Like, it seems like it works well with a more stripped down arrangement. It works well with a larger one.
Yeah.
You ever get tired of it?
Yeah.
Like, I have lots of songs, you know, there's
it's
other ones.
It's been dropped currently.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You got
just
it. Well,
I've just played it so much. And it was getting into this thing, like, I was playing it and I realized I'm thinking about something else.
You're thinking about the laundry or something. Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
It's bad. It's a bad song.
I'm thinking about getting back to my hotel room. But when that happens, that's a true indicator that, you know, you need to put this one aside.
Give it a rest for a bit, yeah.
And then it's fine. Then you come back to it and you're excited to play it again.
Right.
I only want to play the songs that I'm really into.
Sure.
That comes across, you know.
Well, and that's something that's the difference between being a jukebox, like in the room with Bowie, and being an artist. You know, there's feeling behind it, then that feeling has to be honest, or it's going to
be disingenuous. All the bands I've been in, we've always prided ourselves on authenticity. I think that's the most important thing. And an audience really picks up on that. They know if you're authentic or not.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you're not into it, you know, where it's just like, you're just thinking about cashing that check. All right. Oh, great.
No, it's going to be more.
I don't want to spend the entire time talking about Love and Rockets. I do want to talk about So Alive. And what was your thoughts on that when that first came in on the self-titled record?
So Alive?
Yeah. Like your initial impression.
I mean, that came out of nowhere. I mean, it's really Daniel just sort of conjured that up.
Yeah.
And it came together real quick, and we knew we had something very special.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes you hear a song and it's, you know, later on you realize, oh, that's really cool. But is that, that's one where just at the jump you knew?
We instantly knew.
Well, it's got those like Walk on the Wild Side style that, you know, the back of the vocals. Oh, it's so cool.
Yeah, that was that was our reference for that.
Oh, it's perfect. I mean, and it's it's the unexpected nature of it that make it so neat and so cool and so hooky.
Yeah, and John Fryer did a very good job, you know, like production and engineering on that.
Yeah, that's a that's another one that, you know, there's going to be some 15-year-old that engages with that for the first time, you know, every year.
It's got some magic. It's got some magic to it.
It does, and it's got some swagger too. And that's,
And it's also got a little bit of dissonant darkness. If you listen, it's subtle, but I played a keyboard part on that, and Kevin did as well. But they're quite dark. These sort of pads, but the tones and the notes.
Yeah, it's not total nonsense.
Undermine the pop candy coating. So I think that gives it an intrigue.
Well, and in that way that, you know, Lennon and McCartney, right? Where Lennon would sort of try to sabotage some of Paul's more schmaltzier stuff and come up with something weirder instead. And, you know.
Yeah, I almost completely sabotaged that song. I remember because in the studio, Daniel had written the lyrics.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't too keen on the lyrics. But it was just an obvious, it's just a, you know, a, like a love infatuation, lust.
Yeah, just
song. Seeing this girl, it's a true story. Seeing this girl at this party, and I was like turned on by her. But I did suggest at one point, what about making it not about a girl, but about an alien monster creature?
You know, something relatable. Yeah,
it's only revealed at the end. You know,
like, right.
See it for what it is. It's a morphing, and it's like, Dave.
Look, yeah. I'd personally be very into that, but you'll never make Millions catering to my taste. That's all I'm saying. You know, let's do the opposite of for me. Before we move on, tell me about the Bubble Men. I've seen the video. I love it. I love the weirdness. What was going on that created the Bubble Men Are Coming and the Bubble Men?
For years, Daniel would draw those characters. They were doodles. He just absentmindedly drew these little Bubble Men. And then it came to making a video for a track called Mirror People. And he got it into his head that this is when the Bubble Men actually become manifest in the video.
Right.
What if we make the Bubble Men like appear in the video? So we all thought that was crazy and great. And that's when it started. And then they just sort of took on their own kind of identity and momentum and mythos.
Right. And they can rap, and it doesn't reflect on, you know, anybody else necessarily. You know, like they exist in their own universe. So
absolutely.
They own identity
on their own planet. But I came across something which was interesting when I was in Arizona. I went to this. It was an American Indian, Native American shop that sold like artifacts Native Americans, their artwork, and it has some amazing stuff in there. And they had these Kachina dolls,
mm-hmm.
and Hopi tribe, and there was one that looked just like an elongated Bubble Man with the black and the white stripes, the antennae even, and the big eyes, you know. So right. I was really intrigued by this, and I asked the guy, and he said, "Oh yeah, this is a traditional clown doll." And
interesting. Said,
thousands of years. This is probably the original Kachina spirit. These dolls are made to represent these spirits, and this one is very important to their culture. And he's a trickster, and he's a sacred fool. He's like a holy fool, but he also chases the women around the village, and if he thrashes them with an olive branch or this sort of feather thing, then they become pregnant. You know, so he's fertility.
Wow. Okay.
But
talking about a deep mythology, boy.
Yeah, but his main thing is to like poke fun. But in that, he's kind of like an enlightened shamanic clown. And I just thought that was so great, because that's really, in a way, that's how we perceive the Bubble Men.
Yeah, it's interesting to have that.
So we were tapping on some sort of archetype there.
Well, yeah, because it's coming up without your knowledge of that, but hitting some of the same beats.
Yes, I've never seen these things before.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, then I started to collect them.
The collective unconsciousness, that Jungian thing or something, right? Yeah, I mean that's interesting.
That. Yes.
How did you? My understanding with Jane's Addiction, Love and Rockets took them out the first time. That's when that relationship first began, right?
Yeah. Then they took us out in more ways than one on the last tour.
That's right. That was that one. Yes. Were you okay when that event happened?
Yeah.
The event that, if you have the internet, you know all about this event. Were you aware of what was happening?
Well, I was standing at the side of the stage for that gig. I was standing next to my friend Joe Coleman, the artist.
Yeah.
And his lady Whitney. We were watching together because they know Dave. They know Dave and Navarro, and we were all hanging out together. Before the gig, Dave was in a great mood. You know, he was really up and he was just great. And Steve, it was his birthday. He was in a great mood. You know, this is going to be a good one, you know. And then what happened. You know, I actually left just before the incident because, to be frank, it was kind of boring.
Right.
I wasn't feeling the gig.
Yeah.
Sometimes they were on. Sometimes they were great. Other times they weren't so great.
Sometimes someone could be playing very well, but the magic somehow just is not.
Yeah, just was it was right? Just lackluster.
Yeah.
And also, I just felt like Perry's not invested in this. Mm-hmm. It's that authenticity thing, and it didn't feel like that was present. And it was weird. It was a weird gig, and it was kind of uncomfortable, and it had a weird vibe. And I just wanted to leave, so I did. And just after I left, that's when that incident happened.
When it all went down.
We had a meltdown.
Boy.
And then I got back to the hotel and Daniel called me saying, oh, something heavy has just gone down. It's serious.
Boy,
then the tour's off.
There was a bunch of more dates, right?
We were so loving that tour, us playing on that tour.
Sure.
We were playing great. We all felt like playing better than ever. We were just really enjoying the tour. We had a great tour manager. We're just rolling along, and we were doing like gig on, day off, gig on, day off, which is really civilized. We're getting paid, you know, extremely well. Although the actual gravy was about to come in for the gigs that were coming up, because up until then it was pretty much covering all our expenses, which were not inconsiderable.
Sure, sure.
And that was all covered. So now, oh, these gigs, this is when we like get the gravy. But no,
the gravy was not got, as it turns out. Yeah, that's
the gravy train had left the station.
Well, and when people talk about, you know, larger bands canceling tours and stuff, that's often not thought about. It's just the real life cost benefit analysis of just doing it and all the people that are involved, and you know, it's just how much chaos it throws into everything. That's
but it was really like going down the highway, you know, 200 miles an hour. All of a sudden, the brakes are slammed on.
Right. Everything slides forward, and yeah. Hopefully, you get your seatbelt on.
Yeah.
Oof. But I mean, you've had a long relationship with Jane's Addiction. I mean, when I first saw you guys was in the '90s. I think it was the '90s, right? With them, and it was a great show. And I felt that the bands, sounding not really that much like each other, were a good match. I mean,
yeah, I think it was '87 when you took them on tour with us.
Well, I was not cool enough to be on that one, but I think that it's something that, I don't know, that's a shame. It's you hate to see it, right? Where something like that can come apart, and whether substances are involved or not, it's a bummer. Hey, speaking of which, Bauhaus, no more for forever, right? Like there's no chance that's
no.
Yeah.
I figured that was done and dusted.
I mean, After a while, it's I understand the juice ain't gonna be worth the squeeze, as they say, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well,
you know, we've talked about, you know, a large portion of your career so far. How did your mother handle your music career? Was she supportive of it? Was she engaged with it?
She was quietly supportive. My dad was not. No, he was against it. And but I understand. I hated him for that, but it was inspired me. And then I got a different perspective later on because I could just. He was just looking out for me because it was true what he said. You know, why do you think you're going to make it when there's thousands and thousands out there who think the same? Well, you know, get a sensible job. This isn't going to pay. It's not going to go anywhere. It's just a hobby. Keep it as a hobby. You know. It's like that made me really like want to prove him wrong. And then even then when we got success, you know, he had this attitude and he's quite a typical, he said kind of an English thing of if there was any, it might be something that's, it's a successful thing and he might give a kind of sort of begrudged kind of, you know, approval, but then that was immediately followed by some little niggle. Find something, and it would be something that really hurt.
Some damning by faint praise that just can.
Yes.
Like, ding, 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 yeah. Ding, yeah.
My mum was like, "No, it's like, oh, lovely guy, lads. You know, you did great there. That's lovely.
Right.
Sweet."
I found the record. I found the Mother Tree record very interesting, and my mother passed a few years ago, and I definitely found that very profound. That you were able to pay tribute in this very interesting and unique way. And I thought it was super cool. Well, people check the record out. We'll link to it in the show notes, all that stuff that we normally do. There's some other folks that kind of get shout outs, the wrong word. This isn't a rap song, but I mean, you know, Mark Linkus, Sparkle Horse, you know, I was deeply touched by his death and I didn't know him, but it was sometimes, for me, that'll happen where I don't know someone at all, and then like it's like, oh wow, we like lost somebody important, like something.
Yeah,
the world's a little darker today, you know.
Absolutely, he was a beautiful soul.
Yeah,
too sensitive for this world. You know?
Yeah, yeah, and it's a shame because you want to see people like that be protected, but that so often is not the case, right? But it's a cool project, and is the best place for people to get it on your Bandcamp, the DJ Haskins Bandcamp, which is great.
Yeah,
because then it goes straight to you.
And they can go direct to the label, which is Erotox.
Nice.
And both items are available through them because they have a publishing house.
Right, because so there's like you can get like the digital, you can get a record and like the book, all is like one big pre-order, I think, right? And there's
you get a
like
bundle, yeah.
I think there's even a book stand.
Or individually, too. Buy individually.
Yeah, sure. It's great. It's an awesome project. I love it. And there's so much more stuff I'd love to talk to you. I want to be mindful of your time though, and thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you, Kelvin.
Last thing, and this is the only canned question I ever ask people that are on the show, and you can choose to interpret it however you like.
Right.
But why do you do what you do?
I'm driven to do it. It's a kind of addiction in a way. And I think when you're creating, in that moment of creation, you know, there's all sorts of neurochemicals flowing. There's dopamine, there's adrenaline. The serotonin, huge amounts of serotonin, and I really think it's a kind of chemical addiction, you know, to that. And it's I just love being in the moment, especially like writing a song or doing anything visual art or but songs in particular. It's like this you're in this kind of Luciferian light that's just burning so brightly. You are commune. I feel like you are communing with the muse. That whole thing. It's a mysterious interaction, and you become a channel and a conduit for something very mysterious, and I think divine. And I think it brings you, in the act of creation, you get very close to the essence of the divine. So that's pretty damn good.
Beautiful. David J., thank you so much, man. Really appreciate you coming on the show. Take care.
Thank you.
There he goes, the mighty David J. Let's hear something off of the Mother Tree record. I will not play the title track because it is entirely too long for now. But let's hear Ashes and Tea.
With your ashes down the avenue of the Americas, past Washington Square and on to Thompson Street. It was raining and there was no moon. Manhattan shone like a promise in the night. A pretty girl passed by carrying a sunflower, the same color as the cabs that slowed to pick up strangers by the curb. Somewhere far off, a saxophone played. Cockroaches skittered over the stainless steel of the oven as water boiled in a saucepan for my tea.
There you go. That was Ashes and Tea. That's off of the Mother Tree. Let's hear a timeless song. Also by Mr. David J. This is Love and Rockets.
You cannot go against nature, because when you do, go against nature, it's part of nature too. Our little lives get complicated. It's a simple thing, simple as a flower, and that's a complicated thing.
There you go. Love and Rockets. No new tale to tell. For that Ashton T. Is this thing on? David J. Haskins, at least for this record. Like to thank David J. for being on the show. Loved having him. Welcome back anytime, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, you can go to djhaskins.bandcamp.com to pick up the new record, any of those, the Book of Poetry, Rhapsody, Threnody, and Prayer. So many more things, books, magazines. He has a ton of other music, things we didn't get into. But, you know, limited on time, you're limited on time, right? What can you do? He's a busy man. And, yeah, check it out. A lot more than just Bauhaus and Love and Rockets, although that stuff is great. Hey, the name of the show is Conan Neutron's Protonic Reversal. Thank you so very much for listening to it. This show airs generally Thursdays, 8 Eastern, 7 Central, 6 Mountain, 5 Pacific, streaming live on YouTube. Podcasted later everywhere for free, always free. No ads, no sponsors, no kidding. But you want to get episodes sooner and help support the show, patreon.com/protonicreversal will achieve that goal. $1 a month. Helps keep the lights on. Now more than ever. Consider signing up for the Patreon if you listen to the show. Thank you very much. Thanks for everyone liking, subscribing, sharing on your platform of choice. That helps people discover the show and it beats back the almighty algorithm. So thank you for that. Al Johnson. Shorty and U.S. Maple coming up this Wednesday. And Ralph from Rye Coalition with a big announcement on Friday. There's a bunch of cool stuff coming up. Back at it for summer. So stick with it. Keep that app subscribed. Sure.
This microphone turns sound into electricity.
Anything else? No, I think that's it. Stay safe out there. And check
out on Route 128, it's dark and lonely. I got my radio on. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? To my top 10. I'd like to thank our sponsor. But we haven't got a sponsor. Not if you were the last man on earth. She was prepared to prove it. This one goes out to a special girl. There is no special girl! It's the end of radio! The last announcer plays the last record! The last what? Leaves the transmitter! Circles the globe in search of a listener. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
Broadcasting if there's no one there to receive. It's the end of radio. As we come to the close of our broadcast day. Radio. Can you hear me now? Emergency!